Welcome to this week's episode of the First Moves podcast. This week, we're speaking to Kurt Gila, Chief Business Officer at MedAze, which is a young company helping both academics and startups reach stage one clinical trials for their medical innovation as fast and efficiently as possible. Kurt shares the very inspiring story of how he ended up being part of the starting group of MedAze, but also how they're achieving 40 to 70% year-over-year growth with clients from Switzerland to Sweden, counting a total of over 60 clients that they now are already serving within the first effective 5 years of the organization existing. If you want to hear a really inspiring story of how knowledge, expertise, and teamwork made this happen, make sure you listen to this episode. We hope you enjoy.
Kurt, welcome to the podcast. Could you please introduce yourself and share a little bit about your career journey until now?
Sure. My name is Kurt Gila. I have a master's degree in biochemistry, University of Hasselt in Belgium. Realized after my master that I wasn't born to be a scientist, but I really enjoyed or really liked the biomedical research and what people could achieve with that. So my entire career, I worked in the biomedical research industry, always in commercial roles. So I started working for an American corporate for over 10 years, had the opportunity to live and work in Norway for a number of years. At that time, when I left to move to Norway, I thought, okay, this is an intermediate step and then I'll go to the US because that's where the corporate head office was. For a number of reasons, I decided not to do that. So I moved back to Belgium together with my family. And I had this vague idea that I wanted to do something with startups. Learned a lot from those 10 years at the corporate, but I thought, okay, with my experience, maybe there's a startup somewhere that I can contribute to. So through my network, I ended up at the Chemelot campus, Brightlands Chemelot campus in Sittard-Geleen. And at the moment that I was looking for a new challenge, they had open vacancies for business development to help them develop the campus from, as you might know, the former DSM site to a true open innovation campus. Really nice time, very explorative. So we worked with corporates to see whether there were projects that they wouldn't develop that we could potentially set up either through license deals or startups. Run some startup programs, so we brought startups to the campus, helped them to further develop their business planning, their financial planning. And we looked obviously at bringing new companies, new tenants to the campus so that the campus as a whole could grow further. One of the other parts of the campus development was that we realized that we needed to bring early stage research and innovation to the campus, because historically it was more of a campus with a lot of corporates, you know, SABIC, DSM, the big companies. But we thought, okay, if you really want to have an open innovation, you need to have the big ones, the intermediate, the small ones, but also the early stage research. So we attracted a number of research institutes to the campus, one of them being Chemelot Institute for Science and Technology, collaboration between DSM University Academic Hospital in Maastricht and the Technical University in Eindhoven, co-financed by the province of Limburg. And the idea or the intent of the startup was to take late-stage academic project, if I can call them like that, and develop them further so that they were ready to be used in clinical trials. Daniela Kuros, who's now our CEO of MedAze, at that time was a program manager of the institute, and she set up a facility for those internal projects to be able to manufacture for clinical trials. And she also realized that the whole quality regulatory expertise was something that none of these project members knew anything about, but to be honest, also really didn't get enthusiastic about. So she said, okay, why don't I get the entire institute certified for manufacturing of medical devices, which would help the project, because then they could tap into that central expertise and just tweak it for their specific project. Worked really well. Out of those 8 projects, 5 ended up in the patient. So I think for a recent institute, that's quite successful. But what happened is that when the facilities were set up and the certification, everything was in place, a number of startups from Maastricht actually approached the institute and said, okay, what you've built for your internal projects is also something that we need as early stage companies, but we don't have the financial means or we don't have the expertise. Can we make use of those services and those facilities? Was never the intent of the institute to, you know, make commercial contracts with startups, but given the fact that it was co-financed by the province and all of these startups came out of Maastricht, we quote-unquote set up some commercial agreements. And that was really the start of MedAce, because at that moment some of the strategic partners in the region realized that we had uncovered a need in the market which wasn't being served by anybody out there. So that's when in 2018 Danielle and I started to put together the business plan for MedAce. We raised the investment to be able to build new cleaning facilities in Maastricht, which we realized in 2019, and then we started operations January 2020. And as I said, Daniela, because it was her initial idea, she also had the vision, became CEO of MedAce, and given my background, I took on the position as Chief Business Officer. And that's how I ended up here today, 5 years later.
So you mentioned you did a master in biochemistry, but that you realized that the lab work was not for you. At what point did you realize that maybe working in the lab wasn't for you? And were you ever like scared or nervous about making the decision that what you studied and working in the lab, you didn't really want to do that anymore?
I think the moment of realization came when I entered my last year, because that's when you have to do an actual project. And most of the people who do it in Belgium take up projects for close to a year. And I really couldn't see myself doing that. So I find this sort of an escape. So I went to do an international project in Newcastle in the UK, which only lasted for 3 months, which I have to be fair was also a lot easier. It was a very straightforward project measuring the interaction between the new anti-migraine drug and alcohol and how that interacts in the blood. I don't know if we have time for a side story, but during my analysis, we realized that half of the blood samples were actually cluttered. So they didn't mix them well. So then the PI said, okay, we should actually investigate what the effect is of that cluttering of the blood samples on the actual measurements. So one morning I went into the university and there was half a liter of orange juice and quite an amount of vodka waiting for me, which I had to drink in less than 15 minutes. And then they draw blood from me. And half of the samples we mixed well and the other ones we didn't. So we had a comparison between well-mixed and cluttered samples just to be able to identify whether there was an impact on that. So at 11 o'clock, I went back to the old lady that was housing me. And she was like, what the hell have you been doing? It's 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning. Completely wasted.
For science.
Yes. All for science.
Yeah, exactly.
All for the greater good. Turned out there was no effect of the cluttering, so that was good. But I was done with that project in 3 months. And then I realized when I looked at all the other students, like, okay, this is not my thing. So yeah, then you start to think, okay, what else can I do? So first job was, and this was only a few days, was in the food industry. They needed management to oversee a production line. But after 3 days, I realized, no, this is not it either. So I quit, went back. And I honestly don't know how I came across that job position. But somehow I found out that with a scientific background, people are also needed in other types of roles, you know, like sales, marketing. Because back in those days, and I'm talking about 25 years ago, the biomedical industry was a much younger industry, and the only people that could understand what people needed were people with the same scientific background. So I took up an internal sales position, setting up a customer support-like division, answering questions from scientists, but also answering questions from colleagues who had a different background and who didn't get the specifics of those type of research. And that's how I grew from role to role. So, never really scared that I couldn't do anything with my education.
So currently at MedAce, you're the CBO.
Right.
What does that actually entail? And how did you kind of go from this internal sales position, setting up customer contact, essentially, right, to then becoming a CBO?
Well, I mean, then you have to look back at the different roles, right? So internal sales, then I moved to this American company that I just told you about. account manager, just visiting universities, biotechs, former accounts, trying to figure out what they need and what we could sell to them. I mean, that's literally what I did, and obviously also needed, because these researchers don't know what's out there in terms of new technologies, new products, and so on. Did that for a while, and then at a certain point at a sales meeting, I talked to the marketing people, and I said, well, you guys have no idea what you're doing. You don't understand our clients. Your whole marketing approach is completely wrong. And then the marketing director said, well, okay, if you know so well, why don't you come and do it? So I went from sales to marketing, learned that that's a whole different set of expertises, moved into more business management roles, and ended up in that American company as being the global marketing manager for a specific product group. And that already gave me some skills that I currently need now in terms of P&L responsibility, forecasting, product development, sales marketing. I think the role at the Breitling Schemel campus might have been slightly different, but as I said, what I experienced there, having worked for a corporate for 10 years, is the whole field of early stage startup and early stage innovation, and how do you transfer research to an actual product to the market / the patient. And all of that combined pretty much is what I need to do my role as chief business officer. When Danielle and I set up the company, it became obvious that she would be the CEO. You know, me as being the second director, also need a title with a C in it. So I just started Googling, okay, what role are there out there? Because I'm not a financial expert, so I'm not an operational expert. And that's how I came about with the chief business officer. But to be honest, it's just a title. I mean, it doesn't mean a thing. We're 16 people in the company, very flat structure. If the coffee machine breaks down, you know, just like anyone else, I'll be looking at how do we fix this thing. It looks nice on the business card.
So as you say, CBO is just the title. But looking at what your work maybe is a bit inside of MedAce, what does MedAce actually do as a company? What is it there for? What problem does it actually solve?
Yeah. So MedAce is a work learning environment for early stage startups who have an innovation and they need to develop it to be ready to start clinical trials. There's a few things in that description that are important. When people have an idea for a product, they often make like a first prototype, but then actually figuring out how can I make it a robust product, well-defined product, answering a specific medical need, because in our business, you need to have a clear understanding of what the need, what the problem, the disease, whatever is that you're trying to solve or support or whatever. It's a trajectory that there's somehow very little known about. I mean, even if we talk to investors and I ask them, do companies take budget in their financial planning for this? They honestly don't understand how much time and effort it takes to set up a quality management system to make sure that your production and your product requirements actually adhere to the quality and safety regulations. So that's what we support companies with. And then next to that, and that I think is the core of MedAce, when you go for clinical studies, you need to manufacture the product if it's a class 3 device or, for example, a medicinal product like a new cell therapy or whatever. You need to manufacture it in the clean rooms, in a really clean environment. These facilities are hugely expensive to build, so most, if not all, startups don't have the capex to do that investment themselves. They can outsource it to a contract manufacturing organization, but again, in that early stage, there's still quite a lot of development that needs to happen. So either you go back and forth with a CDMO and they continuously charge you because there's stuff that needs to be changed, or they actually take up all the knowledge, and as an entrepreneur, as a startup, you lose track of what actually makes your product so well. So what we came up with is a hybrid model where we try to combine best of both worlds, and we make our cleaning facilities available to startups. They can still focus on their product and their process and their manufacturing development, And we take care of all the surrounding knowledge that's required. How do we run the facility? So it's a fully operational clean room, means that we constantly monitor temperature, pressure, relative humidity, which is data that they need for their technical dossier to be able to submit to get approval to actually go on the market. But you can't build up an entire team as a startup just to manage that, because then you end up with a hugely a massive cost on that side. And as I said, it's a work learning environment, because our investors, who are all strategic partners here in the region, realize that in order to bring innovation from the university or the academic hospital all the way to the patient, there was this gap in the development trajectory. And if you look at development of Limburg as a region, you want to have that whole innovation chain. And we kind of fit that, or fill that gap in between early stage or late stage academic innovation and actually getting to the market. And that's pretty much what we do at MedAce. And we do that both for medical devices, so implants, but also for medicinal products. So we have companies that have implants to fix cartilage damage, all the way to an mRNA client who really took off after COVID, obviously, with the COVID mRNA vaccines, to a stem cell therapy who's trying to enhance or improve fertility with women at a certain age. Because at that time, fertility decreases, and with some technology to stimulate stem cells, they can kind of enhance the quality and the quantity of the eggs that you need to be able to get pregnant.
So it's obviously a very complex process to go from a piece of paper to medical trial and further than that. What is the biggest challenge that you guys have in leading a company that is operating in a field that is so complex, that is medical innovation?
Yeah, the biggest challenge, and this was already the case within the institute, is that if you look at regulatory authorities, they want to have everything separated. They want to have company A in building A and company B in building B, because you don't want to have the risk of contamination whatsoever. And we have set up a shared facility where at time there's 30 companies all working. Not all of them are active in the manufacturing, in the clean room. Some are still in the development phase or working on their quality management system. But we needed to convince these authorities that you can operate a shared facility where multiple companies or even academic groups are doing manufacturing for clinical trials. So going back to the institute, took them about 18 months to convince, in that case, a notified body, because they were going for ISO certification for manufacturing of medical devices. Nice thing is that when the institute received their certification, one of the startups that I was talking about also went to the same notified body. Same auditor came, and he literally said, oh, but it's the same QMS, quality management system, as I saw from MedAce, so I'm going to skip all the, you know, general stuff, and I'm going to focus on your product-specific parts only. And that for us was another first step. And then a few months later, one of the cell therapy companies that was also a part of that facility, they went for the manufacturing license, slightly different route through the IGJ, Instituut voor Gezondheid en Jeugd. Much stricter, because they adhere to the GMP regulation, though with MDR, I think it's kind of getting balanced. And they also got their manufacturing license. And that for us was really the proof that the concept that at that time Daniela had in mind can actually be applied. It's still challenging at times, because every new client that we want to bring in, we have to do a risk assessment to make sure that we don't bring in one client who then jeopardizes the whole system. And that goes all the way to the level of the people working in the facility. So I often say we're sometimes the polite policemen, where people who might come from an academic background need to be told, okay, this is a highly regulated environment. You can't just get away with stuff under your arm walking through the front door. No, it has to follow certain procedures and routes to bring stuff into to the facility, so that you don't jeopardize the other activities. Yeah, and that's, I think, the biggest challenge that we had to deal with over the last 5 years.
I think it's very noteworthy, though, the very integrated support system that you've created, because you have both infrastructure as a service, but you also have this regulatory knowledge. And so facilitating that process goes extremely effectively, apparently. I guess it's quite unique.
It is quite unique, and it's a really good point that you touch on, because whatever you do in the clean room, you have to write down first what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. And then you take that documentation in the clean room and you follow exactly step by step what you said and written down that you're going to do. Sometimes you can put something on paper, but then when you try to put it in operations, it just doesn't work. And you're absolutely right. Then the efficiency to update it and go back is unseen. Where if you would work with a consultant and then you have to do it, then you have to go back to him, and there's always this lag time. So the throughput for implementing change can be quite fast, for sure.
And I think that's also noteworthy with what you said before we started the recording, that, I mean, Medace is not an old company. You effectively started working in the labs in January 2020.
Yeah.
COVID came, so that slowed you down. But still, 5 years after that, I think you mentioned you have more than 60 clients from all across Europe. So that growth came very quickly, also 40 to 70% growth year over year. So you've tapped into something that is quite established, but I think still leveraging that is very difficult. So how have you guys been able to make sure that capacity-wise you keep these things aligned, that you make sure that you're meeting the certain standards? I'm guessing that's quite a lot of balls to juggle.
Well, I think, first of all, you're absolutely right. Concept driven by, you know, a local institute, a few companies here in the region. But I think everyone involved understood quite rapidly that if you want to help early stage startups, you have to come up with a model that fits their needs, which means you have to acknowledge that funding is limited. You have to acknowledge that knowledge, for example, quality, regulatory, but even just how do you set up a manufacturing process, again, is limited. And you have to build a model in such a way that it fits those needs. So yes, we try to keep our organization as lean, as mean as possible, because if we build out an organization of 100 people, that are costs that we have to calculate in our tariffs to clients, it's not going to work. And you have to also understand, okay, what are the areas of expertise that we want and can support clients with? So our facility manager has built two cleaning facilities now and has run cleaning facilities for over a decade. He knows what they need in terms of data, but he also knows if things go wrong, how to fix them. And that's the secondary support that we get clients that they don't even realize that they need it when they started working with us. And that's also why I think people from Switzerland to Sweden actually come and work with Medace here in Maastricht. I mean, literally had a company saying, based in Sweden, we've done everything in the lab. We now need to test it out in a clean room, but we can't access clean rooms because the companies that have clean rooms keep it close to their internal projects and their own personnel. Or you go to an academic facility. Again, some downsides there. So he just sent over a bunch of his people and they worked in our facility for 3 months. Fortunately, everything worked out. So what they were able to do is manufacture product that they then could use for compatibility testing, packaging, those kind of things. But what I think you're also hinting at is, yes, it's a very challenging target audience. So we need to be flexible in adjusting capacity, and as you said. Also because timelines for any startup are always uber optimistic. So I think that's also some lessons learned for us in the past 5 years. If a company says, yes, I'm ready to go into a clean room in a month's time, we do an assessment up front just to, with our experience, look at those timelines. And then almost always we can kind of guess that's probably going to be a little bit longer than 1 month. So, but that's the experience that you build up. And then you have to find the ways to convince also your clients when they say, I need a clean room next month, that we're pretty certain that it's going to take longer. Because quite often that's also what they've budgeted for. So that comes back to understanding their needs and how do you deal with that.
So a really big part of the uniqueness of Medace as well is to offer a more cost-effective way of doing all of this work in the clean room.
Flexible. In the end, the costs are the cost. I mean, if you want to set up a quality management system, you're going to spend one or two FTE for a number of years. And you can't get away from that because that's just what's required to build a quality management system. A clean room costs what it costs because, you know, it's highly costly to operate it, keep the airflow going and everything. So how do you then come up with a solution where an early stage company can still make use of those facilities or those services? And that's where flexibility comes into play. Like I said, the Swedish company, they needed to test out their processes in a cleaner environment. And if it would work out well, then there was a whole other stuff of work that they needed to do before they would be ready to actually do manufacturing for their clinical trials. So the flexibility offered by us is really what helped them to progress in that development trajectory. Then they went away because they had to do other stuff and they didn't have the burden of that cleaning facility, which we then occupied with other clients. So I think it's mostly in the flexibility that that we can differentiate.
I think what I'm also getting from the things you're telling us now is what's very notable about Medis as a company is the very strong knowledge and experience you have as a team. Mm-hmm. The clean room technician working, you know, for more than a decade in the field, your background, understanding only the technical aspects, understanding what innovation needs actually to move along inside different projects, but also having the business acumen to know how to leverage that. I'm wondering, how do you build your team based off of that, looking for those right constellation of knowledge and experience to make sure that you can kind of leverage the concepts that's already there?
Yeah, that's a good question. Over the past 5 years, we've become very well aware of where we can make a difference for our clients. If I look back when we started, we had a quality manager, but we had no regulatory support. And over time, we've come to realize by working with a number of clients that that was hampering us in terms of our service and the support, and it was hampering our clients. So I think over probably a year and a half ago, I don't know if Linda will ever see this, but it always feels like people have been around forever. But I think it was a year and a half ago, we brought in a regulatory expert, which was an area that we identified that there was also a huge need. Same goes for the manufacturing, right? We always would like our clients to come and do the manufacturing themselves because that's how they build up that knowledge and that's how the knowledge within their team and their organization grows. But always, that's not always possible. You know, we had one company in Switzerland said, love to come work with you, but our CTO is a mother with two small children. She just can't travel. So that's also when we realized, okay, we need to expand our services by having operators available to do the actual manufacturing. Now, they're not experts on any particular product, but they're experts on how do you manufacture a given product in a clean room setting. Touching a table, something that you do automatically, or moving around in a lab, is something that's not allowed in a clean room because you have constant disturbance or the risk of getting a contamination because you touch certain areas. And it's that kind of mentality and experience that they bring that clients don't have. And that's why we always work so closely with the clients, because they are the expert on their product. We're the expert on how do you manufacture that product in, for example, a clean room environment. And that's where you, as management, you need to be very focused and very aware, okay, where are we making a difference? And what kind of personnel, how do we build a team so that we can actually service our clients in the best way possible?
And again, that requires experience and expertise to know where the gaps are to begin with,
yeah.
I can imagine. And yeah. A constant awareness to know how things are changing and how to make sure that you're actually solving the problem and not falling in love with the solution that Medis originally maybe was.
Oh, I can tell you that we've went through a lot of changes in the last 5 years. But again, I think that's part of starting a company.
Exactly.
You know, business plan sounds good, but as I told you in the introduction, the best MBA is just to go and become an entrepreneur, and then you learn all the theory while actually doing it. It's probably more impactful than doing a four-year MBA, if I personally think. That's clear as my opinion.
I don't think my opinion is not in disagreement.
Right. Not mine either. So talking about the challenges and the changes you've also made, you said, during the last 5 years, what is a success story that really stands out to you from what you've done with MedAce? Maybe that's a company that came there, mm-hmm. or something MedAce did. What is like one of those success stories that really is like, boom, that was really impressive?
Do you want to hear one or 60? I mean, I think not all of our collaborations with clients have been successful. Sometimes things just don't work out. Could also be just because the product doesn't work. But there's a few that come to mind. We have one company that develops mRNA-based products. They started selling to the R&D, the research community, like universities, those kind of things. And then obviously when COVID hit and everybody realized that we can make great vaccines based on mRNA, they realized that in order to be successful, they needed to move into the whole GMP, the good manufacturing space. But they had nobody within their organization that had any knowledge about it whatsoever. And for them, we were a perfect fit because, you know, that's what we bring is GMP, clean manufacturing. So through that collaboration, they were actually able to make fast progress in an area that was completely unknown to them as a company. That's one. One which I think, if you look at it as a client and financial impact and what have you, is minimal. But at a certain moment in time, we got contacted by a supplier of a piece of equipment that we have, which is called a joint simulator. And what it does, it can mimic any joint in the human body. Used, for example, a cartilage implant, you want to make sure that you can test how it will behave if you put it in a knee. So the supplier contacted us and said, I've got this orthopedic surgeon in South Africa who's developing his own implant, who needs to do this kind of testing. And this is an equipment that's, you know, in the range of several hundred thousand of euros. He can't afford it. And I mean, just to do some testing would also be quite an investment. And nowhere in the area was there any equipment to be found. And he said, I've mentioned MedAce and your concept that you facilitate startups or academics to make progress in their development. Would you be, or could you actually get in contact with him? So we've spoken to him and we told him, look, we've got the equipment, we've got the expertise. You need to bring in the testing that you want to do. So we hired a researcher here in the region who used to work on the instrument back in the days when it was still the Institute. He brought in his implant, said, this is the kind of testing that I want to do. And together with him, and then later on, he also came over himself to do some testing. But we were able to help him further develop his implant. And I think that's a nice story because there's someone in South Africa can't progress with his development. I don't know whether the implant is awesome or it's just a me too product, but honestly, we don't care, right? It's really that you help people develop their innovation further. Minimal impact, small project, but I think from a broader social, cultural, economic perspective, it's in my opinion, it's a great example.
Fair. And I think that's also something that you said yourself, which is what innovation happens when you combine the strengths of researchers, startups, and clinicians surrounded by the right expertise and resources.
Yeah.
Right? So you had someone who was there who wanted to come with an idea.
Yeah.
And you guys had the expertise and the setting to bring that one step further.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's also, if I go back to the Institute, you know, all the projects, the internal projects, always had a clinician on board. You know, a researcher from the University of Maastricht and then someone from the Technical University in Eindhoven, and quite often, if not always, someone from DSM with the material expertise, because these were all implants, medical devices, and the type of material and what have you is so important, and that each project team had a different set of skills that together, because the clinician could say, yeah, but you know, if you make it from that material, then it's not going to, for example, there was an eye product, it fell out of the eyelid because the material was not made in the right way. But you have that that set of skills that you need to further develop a project or product, it's essential. You can't go without it. And I think that's what is going to become even more important, because research is just getting more complicated than it ever was. So the diversity of skills and expertise needed is just going to expand. So I honestly believe the only way to tackle those is through more intense collaboration, through companies, through institutes, companies, and other stakeholders.
Yeah, and I think a fundamental argument for it is that the more specialized knowledge and skills become, kind of the bigger the gaps get between them.
Yeah.
And so the only way to really foster any kind of effective innovation, also the more we innovate, not that there's maybe a limit to it, but I mean, the universe is, you know, only so big, as you could say, or infinitely big. But still, I think there's, to bridge those gaps, you need to learn how to work together.
Yeah.
Is that also something that maybe you guys run into now? I'm wondering, of do you guys also facilitate the startups with their internal processes a bit, in terms of they're running into problems of how they might further develop? Is that something that you guys also offer?
Yeah, the question makes me laugh, because quite often we see areas where we could support startups in all different matters of you know, how to run a business. But we've made the decision not to go there. I mean, if you need support in your financial planning or in raising funding, there's plenty of companies out there who already do that or are specialized in that. And that's where we say, okay, we stick to our particular niche of support, or niche, you know, our particular area of expertise. We might broaden it if it's complementary, but there's areas where we consciously say, okay, you know, we could, but we're not going to help there because there's other companies or organizations out there. And that comes back, you know, you need to find that consortium of organizations to be successful.
So it's just focusing on being the best you can at
what we do,
what you do exactly, yeah. And not trying to get all kinds of other things.
Yeah, and we're still improving, right? So we constantly have internal improvement projects. I mean, if you set up a quality management system, after 5 years, you've learned that some of the things that you set up initially could be more efficient, could be easier, could be faster, might even be redundant. So that's where we continuously look for improvement, so that and we make sure that, as you say, we try to be the best at what we do.
Fair. But I think as an organization, at least I could imagine, that's trying to basically make their clients as successful as possible. I could imagine it's a hard reflex to then go, ah, I know it could help with that. But it's not in our definition of who we are. So we need
to
take
a step
back.
There's only 8 hours or 24 hours in a day. And I'll try to work 8 to 10 hours per day. So if... You sometimes you learn the hard way.
Of course.
It's where you suggest that you help out, and then you end up in something that takes much more time than you had anticipated and even had hoped for. And that's where you realize, okay, I sometimes need to learn how to say no.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what we then always try to do is we try to direct them to other companies or partners that can help out in that area, because you still want to help them to a certain extent.
Exactly. Yeah. Fair.
I think there's a lot of value in having the ability to say no to something, but then helping them onto other parts.
So yeah.
Say, we can help you, but these people can help you. I think as a startup, I can see a lot of value in that when I talk to different organizations where they're saying, okay, we can help you this far, but then go talk to those people and they can help you further than on that point.
Yeah, and I think if you get a little more senior, you realize that the network that you build up is probably so valuable, because you know you can just pick up the phone, call anybody with any question, and almost always you get an answer saying, go talk to him, go talk to her, or talk to that company. Yeah, and if you can give back to other companies, well, why not? Mm.
And also from my experience as the startup, if you say no to things, it also works in your favor, or just you as Medes. It helps you say no, because it very clearly delineates who you are and who you aren't, which then makes it a lot easier for people to understand what you do.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, when they talk about who you are, it's a far easier story to tell. And yeah. So knowing who, you know, Medis has probably made a bit of its name by itself or for itself by now.
Yeah.
So I could imagine that that also goes into it by just having a very clear definition of what you are.
Absolutely.
And what you do.
I mean, otherwise you just waller everything down and nobody knows what you really do.
Yeah. A friend of everyone is a friend to no one, I think.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. I'm fair. Probably not good at anything either.
Also, yeah. Also. All right, Kurt, we've spoken a lot about what Medis is, how you got there, et cetera, but we're curious, what is next for the company? And then maybe what's next for you?
What's next for the company? From the start, we realized that what we've created and set up here in Maastricht, we don't want to grow that facility 10 times the size it is now. We've realized that proximity is very valuable. So in the original business plan, we always said, okay, the long-term strategy it is to set up similar hubs in other regions across Europe. Can't share too much about it, but we actually are having quite nice conversations with a number of regions in Europe. One of them was actually triggered by a massive university in a country that's no longer part of EU, so I'm sure you can figure out which one that is, who are doing a lot of support for their startups. And one of the senior people there said, the next step that we need is to offer small-scale manufacturing. Now, they're working with a real estate company who are supporting them with office lab spaces, but no experience with small-scale manufacturing. And they met us at a conference where we had a booth, and as you said, clear message. So he kind of came, do you guys do small-scale GMP manufacturing? And our business developer, my colleague who was there, said, yeah, that's what we do. So that's how the ball got rolling there. Another region was coming back to the company, said, you know, love to work with you, but can't get my people to Maastricht. And then quite often when that happens, the next question is, but why is there no Maastricht in Switzerland, Spain, France? So we're following some of those trajectories as well. Keep in mind that, you know, building a facility like what we have here in Maastricht does take quite a lot of investment. So you need to have a local or a number of local partners to help you realize that. So the first trajectory I was talking about, you have this academic partner, you have a real estate organization, and you have Medis and our knowledge and expertise. So that kind of, again, forms a nice consortium to set up a similar facility in other regions as well.
Very fair.
So the future, the way I see it, is that we have 10 to 15 Medis all over Europe and who knows, even beyond.
Very bright future then.
Yeah, the added benefit is that you then have manufacturing sites in different countries and with clinical trials in different countries and, you know, regulations still being different in different countries, or even, you know, UK stepping out of Europe now setting up their own regulation. You can kind of get that bridge functionality that you can also, that will also be or should also be useful for startups in that phase.
Now that you say that with different regulations in different countries, it just makes you think of Arion. And that they have the border running through their building, so they can actually produce in Germany and in the Netherlands. They can just move it around, and that's what they did for the ease of certain qualifications that you need in certain countries.
Exactly, yeah. So that's already a company that experienced it. I don't think that's a solution for every company building something on the border, but that's where I think, or where we think that there's also a benefit by having multiple hubs across Europe.
And it comes back to the point of collaboration you said earlier as well, in terms of that's where the value is.
Yep.
And, you know, between those different parties, because then you start to create more localized expertise.
Exactly.
Which then you can use to bridge gaps further and help your clients on an even higher scale.
Yeah, I mean, for example, if we would set up a facility in the UK and companies from Europe want to enter the British market or vice versa, they can kind of tap into the knowledge, you know, here in Maastricht and UK and say, okay, how do I enter Europe and what's specific or what do I need to do differently than versus the UK? So
fair.
So Kurt, we have this closing tradition on the podcast where we ask our guests to come with an object of great significant meaning for their personal or career life.
Mm-hmm.
What did you bring for us today?
I brought something very small and it's a rock. No, actually it's not a rock, it's a stone. But it has something imprinted on it, and I've had this stone now probably for 25 years. And it's in my bag, so I carry it with me pretty much everywhere I go. And the text on it says, "Thoughts become things." Now, there's quite a long story behind it. I've been depressed between age of 19 and 25, 26. Really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life or even why the hell I was living my life. Found the answer to that question in a Buddhist book from the Dalai Lama, who said, the reason for living is to be happy. And I closed that book and I thought, okay, that's the answer, but then how the hell do you get happy or be happy? So I spent a lot of time on reading books, both philosophy, psychology, and I had the fortunate fortune that I actually met my wife, who's happy every day from morning to evening. And when I met her for the first time, I thought, okay, I want to be like that. One thing I learned is that your thinking, your thoughts have a massive impact on not only your happiness, but also how you behave, the things that you do. And this is a stone from a guy called Mike Dooley. It's one of these American gurus where you can buy, you know, self-help books and training programs. But this guy has a really unique approach to it. He pretends to be the universe, and you can subscribe to his daily emails. And he says, okay, I'm the universe, and I'm going to help you with whatever you want. Which is really weird, because every day you get an email from the universe saying, hey, Kurt, good job, man. I saw that you're working hard and doing this and this. And by the way, those big dreams and that thing that you want in the past, I'm taking care of that. Mm. But this stone reminds me when, you know, and it doesn't always work, right? I mean, we all have shitty days and we all have stress and we all have problems. But sometimes when I open my bag and then I see this stone and I thought, okay, I can worry about it, you know, or I can stop worrying about it, see what I can do about it, and try to be as happy, as positive, or as productive, for whatever that means, possible. So it helped me on my personal life, and it also helps me in my professional life, because if you start a company and then 2 months later COVID hits, that could be really challenging. Or you could say, okay, how can I approach this? You know, where can we see the opportunity? How can we deal with this kind of situation? And then you find that, quote unquote, the universe in the form of people like investors are there to help you out. Because the first thing that happened when COVID hit, our investors said, hey, nobody could predict this. We're going to get you through this, even if it means that there's an additional investment needed just to get you through these two tough years. So that's why I brought a stone with three words on it.
Very deep meaning of the stone and the object.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think also for me, I mean, I'm also a human being, constantly learning and growing, or at least trying to. And I think lately I very much realized that a big part of my maturation process has been understanding the ability to mentally flip my surrounding. And of course, you kind of learn this early on. I think when you're a teenager, you start to learn that. But I think now it's becoming really much more of a habit where I can say, Stan, okay, no, you're going through the situation, just flip your mental switch.
Yeah.
And then it just helps insanely much with how you feel, how you experience things. And then whatever you put into those things, usually you also get it back out.
Yeah. And I mean, you learn also through living, right? As I said, I met my wife and she's positive almost every day, all day. But also raised with a can-do mentality, where my father, if whatever project needed to be done, his first reaction was, oh, that's not going to work. Mm. Where my wife was like, well, why don't we give it a try? And then you saw that the mindset from my dad also shifted, and also he came up with solutions. So it's also in your childhood and how you were raised and through life, you're like, okay, I can worry about everything all the time, or I can just say, okay, how do I change my mindset, my thoughts about it? And then you actually just try stuff out.
Yeah.
And then my father-in-law would come in, oh, we do this. That doesn't work. Okay, then we do this. And the 37th idea that he had, that would be the right one. Yep. But at least we had the solution. So, yeah.
Yep.
Whether it's part of becoming old or whether I was just a late learner, I don't know.
Fair. Fair. All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, guys. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank really you enjoyed very much.
It. Yeah.
Wonderful. Never did a podcast, never actually listened to a podcast. So, listen to yours.
There we go. Thanks. Nice. All right. Thank you so much. And yeah, we'll see you around.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thank you.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our episode. If you want to connect with our guest personally, then give us a follow on LinkedIn at First Moves. We also have an Instagram at First Moves Podcast. And lastly, we ask you to leave a review. This will enable us to bring better guests on board and give you better content in the future. Have a nice day.